Are you ready to awaken to a new you? Welcome to Healthy You Radio, the radio network that empowers you to heal you. Dr. Keisha Yours is here to share over 30 years of frontline medical experience, bringing you the latest scientific and medical research tempered with the holistic wisdom of Ayurveda and functional medicine, all so you can be the best you can be. And now your host, Dr. Keisha Yours.
Welcome to Healthy You Radio, everybody. This is Dr. Keisha Yours, your wellness coach and advisor for today. I'm bringing you radio that empowers you to heal yourself. And good afternoon, Eric.
Good afternoon, Keisha. How are you on this fine day?
Well, it's a fine day. Loving it.
Awesome.
Yes. Summer in Seattle can't be beat.
True enough. Except when we have a fantastic guest on the show, of course, then that makes it even better, right?
Exactly. It's Wednesday. It's that day I get to talk to really cool visionary people that are making their mark in the world of wellness and health with their various fields of expertise. And of course, today is no exception. Our guest today is Arjuna Arda, who is an awakening coach and has trained more than 1,300 others to facilitate awakening. And he's the author of 8 books, including his latest, Better Than Sex, The Ecstatic Art of Awakening Coaching. Welcome to Healthy You Radio, Arjuna.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you guys.
Well, you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to people that are making a positive impact on others and helping them along the path. And there's nothing better that can encapsulate that than coaching, right?
Coaching is a wonderful evolutionary leap for humanity. You know, we take it for granted so easily these days because, you know, you hear so often people say, I'm a coach. You know, we take it for granted. We forget that go back 25 years only, and we only ever heard the word coaching in one context. And that was, of course, in sports. You know, so as little as 25 years ago, coaching was only a relationship that happened in sports. Coaching is beautiful because it's anti-hierarchical. You know, it's a coach supports somebody else to be brilliant. Instead of saying, I'm brilliant, follow me, a coach is saying, you're brilliant, let me support you. And so it's been a huge revolution to bring that coaching relationship into wellness, into executive coaching, into all kinds of arenas, and now we've done this, taken this additional step of bringing coaching into the world of spirituality so we can dissolve the old hierarchical guru-based relationship which we've been struggling with for such a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny because I'll have patients, I have an integrative medical clinic, and I'll have patients that will say to me, you've transformed my life and I have never felt better and I can't believe I can feel this good. And I'll say, you know, my relationship with you is as a coach. You know, I've given you advice and you followed it. Like I give you the program and then you follow it and then you get the outcome. And I just think that's a marvelous thing. And definitely that the idea that I have as a medical provider is much different from the physician-patient relationship of the 1950s where doctor knows best, you know?
Exactly.
And I just don't think of it
that
way.
I heard on the introduction to the show that you're trained in Ayurveda. And what I love about Ayurveda is that it is incredibly empowering to the patient, you know? And
right.
In Ayurveda, the philosophy is to... for the patient to learn how to heal themselves as quickly as possible. And I actually was able to overcome all kinds of genetic illnesses for myself through learning how to change my lifestyle. So I think you're right. Ayurveda is really the closest thing to coaching in the medical field.
Mm-hmm. And I also do functional medicine, and that's very much the same idea where together the doctor and patient come together and get, you know, listen to the story, get to the root problem and say, okay, here are the barriers that are keeping you from your best health. And so I think, and that's more of a westernized model of, you know, the conventional medicine model that we're familiar with. And I just love it because I think, okay, finally it's making it into the medical world where you don't turn over your own power of discernment to somebody else. That's why we have such a litigious society is because we say, you know, turn everything over and say, fix me. And if that doesn't work exactly how we think, then we get upset.
I think you're totally right there. You know, I think you're totally right. And when you talk about, you know, in functional medicine, the factors that affect health, it's interesting to consider what they are. And in my experience, the number one thing in our society that affects people's well-being, it's not access to clean drinking water like it might be in Africa.
Right.
And it's not, you know, polio or whooping cough or even influenza, which killed many of our ancestors. The number one thing that I see that influences people's well-being is what we generically refer to as stress. You know, but it's become such a widely used word that I think it's worth considering together what exactly is stress. You know, what does it mean? What is stress? And there's lots of different definitions to stress. So I've really taken it on myself to investigate with people who are feeling stressed what exactly is happening for them. What is going on subjectively, which gives rise to the experience of stress? And my little definition of that, for what it's worth, I would say that stress is always the result of resisting what is occurring. All right? So that means that could be that you're having a thought. You know, you're having a thought of I'm not good enough, or you're having a temporary thought of there's not enough money. And if you allow that thought to pass, just as a thought which has its own opinion, you don't get stressed. But if you have the thought there's not enough money, and then it's accompanied by the resistance that I don't want to experience that, you feel stressed. And that has an immediate effect, as we all know, on the body. Same thing if you have an emotion arises, if anger comes. I've realized that feeling anger is actually good for you. It's great to feel anger and let it pour through your body, not to dump it onto other people. But if you go in a room and, you know, beat a cushion and scream and really, you'll feel better. But having anger arise and then not wanting to experience anger, that creates stress. So that's been a big focus of awakening coaching, as you know from the book, is with awakening coaching, we start by introducing people to their true nature as limitless consciousness. And we do that not conceptually, but experientially, so that you can really have an experience of investigating yourself much as you might investigate the sky and realize that it has no limits. But then we ask, well, if it's so easy to have a taste of your true nature as free, as loving, as resourceful, as playful, if it's so easy to drop into that, why do we subjectively feel like we lose it so easily? Why do we feel that we lose that connection? And the answer that I would come up with, as you know, that's in the book, is it's the same thing. It's resistance. Resisting what is occurring not only creates stress, but it also creates the subjective experience of being disconnected from yourself and disconnected from life. So that's what we do with awakening coaching, is we've developed technologies to not to get rid of stress particularly. Some stress is healthy. Not even to get rid of thoughts and feelings, or not even to transform negative thoughts into positive thoughts and all that stuff. All we're really doing that makes a huge difference is relaxing resistance. Learning how to truly relax resistance so that your truly creative self can step forward. And that dimension of you, which is free, which is limitless, which is playful, always knows what to do and always knows how to turn challenges into opportunities.
You know, it's interesting because I think the idea of resistance is an important one. And I was working with a patient not too long ago who, you know, I think everyone that you probably coach tells you exactly what's wrong, even if they're not sure, as far as their own barriers, just the same as I get in my office through language. And she said, I feel like I'm always walking on a tightrope and I'm afraid I'm going to fall off again. And so when we started talking about why this tightrope was here, you could look at it as a mathematical equation where on one side there was this huge expanse of pressure that she was putting on herself to achieve some goals that were all huge and monstrous, and she wanted to do it all at the same time. And so on the other side of the equation is this tiny little line that's left over for space for her to move in, you know?
Yeah.
And so we started talking about how to balance that equation so it looked a little bit different. And I asked her to check in with her body and where the resistance was in the body, because you'll always feel that in the body. When you feel resistance, it's going to be in the body also.
Mm.
And she, you know, as we worked together, she could feel it leaving until finally she felt that openness and that freedom, and we knew that we'd arrived at the balance, the place where enough stress on one side of the equation was present, and it made an equal amount on the other side of clearing for her to move in to be able to do something.
So, beautiful. Yeah,
yeah,
beautiful.
It's a very interesting, very mathematical kind of way of thinking about it that makes a lot of sense. And
yes.
So, you know, when we pressurize our lives in that way and we have that resistance that builds up, you're going to have a repercussion in your body. It's just a given. It's why I went into psychotherapy in addition to medicine, because I realized you can't separate these things out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right on, you know, and it takes such a re-education. It takes such deep realignment, because we are so conditioned to believe that our suffering is caused by external circumstances, and more specifically, we're conditioned to believe that our suffering is caused by the will of other people.
Right.
And we do that, you know, in an intimate relationship, we say, well, my spouse's behavior is making me suffer. Or we say, my teenage children's behavior and choices is making me suffer.
Or
we expand it out. We say, my boss's decisions are making me suffer. And then the final version is, you know, the government and even the world government, you know, and big corporations are making me suffer. But we realize then, you know, those outside forces may be determining circumstances up to a certain degree. But the really important factors that create suffering actually are to do with our relationship to reality more than the content of the reality itself. And it's very, 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 it takes tremendous patience and almost like discipline to be able to turn that around, because it's the habit in all of us to blame external things and then to feel like a victim of circumstances beyond our control. It goes so deep that it requires a continuous re-education. This is why in awakening coaching, we use a method called radical releasing, which takes very few minutes. It just takes like less than 5 minutes. And radical releasing, it simply removes the resistance, you know. So maybe you have I was just working with a group today. I was training some coaches today on the phone just like an hour ago. And one of the guys on the phone, he was a psychotherapist from Germany who's now learning to be a coach. And he was talking about when people are vague. He said, the problem I have is people are vague and they don't really say what they mean, and it's kind of manipulative when somebody's vague. And he went on about this thing, and I said to him, well, I said, just imagine those vague people standing in a little group in front of you. And I said, point your finger to them and say, you're vague. And so he did. He took his finger and he pointed at them and said, you guys are vague. And I said, now, look at your hand. He said, yeah, looking at my hand. I said, tell me where each finger is pointing. And sure enough, he got it right away, that one finger was pointing at the people, but three fingers were pointing back at him, you know?
Right.
And so actually, and then I pointed out to him, we had 20, 30 people on the call who were training to be coaches, and I checked in with a few of them, and I said, how many people feel irritated by vague people? And it was not a common complaint. So I said to him, how come you are irritated by vague people, but most of the other people on the call have other things they're irritated by? And so he kind of slowly got it that the vague people were not the problem. It was his resistance to vagueness, and specifically the resistance to vagueness in himself, that was the problem. What he was suffering from was resistance, not something else. And it was interesting, because then somebody else piped in and said, well, I want to just say that when he was talking about vagueness, I felt I did not like that. I did not like the way he was talking about that. It felt very judgmental. I said, okay, good. So you didn't like it, right? And they said, how do you know you didn't like it? And you had these symptoms. I said, good. So when he was being judgmental, just try saying that. Just try pointing the finger and say, you're being judgmental. And he got it right away as well. The other guy's judgmentalness was not the problem. It was his resistance. So slowly we realize that you can live in heaven in this moment now. You can live in heaven not by creating the absolutely perfect picture book lifestyle. You can live in heaven by relaxing the habits of resistance to what is here. And then miraculously, two things happen. First of all, what is already here becomes more beautiful. You know, your spouse becomes more beautiful when you're not resisting and judging. And the place where you live becomes more beautiful when you're not full of complaint. And your work becomes more interesting when you're not resisting it. But then there's another magic, which is because your energy is now in a spirit of gratitude and celebration, better things come into your life. It's an incredible thing. You know, it's nicer, more juicy things come into your life because gratitude and appreciation, when it's natural, not when it's fabricated, but when it's natural, gratitude and appreciation actually magnetizes a good life.
That's absolutely true, and it, and the opposite is true also, obviously, because we get into that separation place of, you know, I do something very similar called mirror exercise, mirror work, that I was given to by Ramana Maharshi when I was in a cave in India, and it, you know, it all comes down to the same thing where you say, okay, whatever I see in front of me is a reflection of a disowned part of myself that I'm not so willing to look at, so I'm going to project it out. So we feel separate from the other, and you talk about separation in your book, and that's a, you know, that's a big cause of suffering for a lot of people when they think there's a me and a them.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the let's think of it like waves in an ocean, you know, like waves in an ocean. Let's imagine a wave, because a wave, temporarily, a wave in the ocean does have an identity. So the wave is moving along the surface of the ocean, and the wave temporarily feels like I'm a wave, and I'm kind of frothy, and I'm moving, and the wave could look at other waves and say, oh, I'm more frothy than the wave next to me, but oh, no, I'm not quite as big as that wave, and how come the surfers are more interested in that other wave than in me? The wave can set up a whole personal story, but of course we know when we look at it from the outside that the wave is a very temporary phenomenon. It lasts for a few seconds, you know, that the wave picks up speed, it has its life journey, and then it crashes onto the shore, and of course then the wave is gone in that particular incarnation. Now, when a wave is feeling separate, and looks at the other waves and says, I'm a separate wave. If the wave takes a moment, just a moment, to look back into itself, if the wave asks itself the question, who am I really? And turns its attention away from the other waves into itself, what does it discover? If a wave turns its attention onto its own subjectivity, of course the wave, looking into itself, will see ocean. It will then see, by looking inwards, the wave sees, I actually am the ocean. It will not even see I'm part of the ocean, because there's no dotted red line between the ocean and the wave. The wave will see, I am the ocean. I actually am the ocean itself. And in that recognition, immediately recognizing I am the ocean, temporarily expressing as this wave, the wave simultaneously will get it that all of the waves are the ocean. So now this begins a beautiful dance where the wave can look at the other waves and see, okay, we're two waves. Temporarily, we're two waves expressing our waviness. And somebody's more frothy, and somebody's faster, and somebody's taller, and somebody's got more surfers. But it's only an appearance. What's really true is we are all of us ocean. We're all ocean. I am ocean, you're ocean, it's the same ocean. Now, actually, that's, of course, a little made-up story because waves don't really look at other waves and compare themselves as far as we know. But it is a great analogy because exactly the same transformation is possible for human beings. That we look outside into the world and we have a relationship then to the world where we say, I am the body. And the world is separate from me. And I have my source of thoughts, and you have your source of thoughts. And if your source of thoughts disagrees with mine, then we've got conflict. And, of course, that's what's happening right now today in Gaza. There's, you know, a temporary ceasefire since a couple of days, but there's a big conflict there between people, and the conflict is about their religion. You know, the conflict is about their experience of God. It's a strange thing to kill people over, but that's the essence of the conflict. You know, the people living there were, most of them, born in the same, well, I guess a lot of people moved to Israel after the war, but a lot of the people were born in the same geographical area. So they share a lot of the same things. They just have a disagreement about their beliefs. Same thing in Northern Ireland. You know, it's calmed down now, but there used to be a lot of violence in Northern Ireland between the Irish and the Northern Irish, and there was a conflict about religious belief. And it was even different expressions of Christianity. It was, everybody loved the same Jesus. Just somebody said, I love Jesus and his authority is in Rome. And somebody else says, I love Jesus, his authority is in Canterbury, in England. And that was enough to kill each other. You know, so it's ridiculous when you look at it. But that's what happens when you're identified with being separate. Then any kind of difference with another person becomes a source of conflict. On the other hand, the analogy of a wave with the ocean is when you pay attention to your own true nature, when you pay attention to that, which in this very moment is experiencing all of this. I'm not talking about some future state of enlightenment or, you know, chakras twirling and all that stuff. I'm saying right now in this moment, as you hear sounds, as you feel sensations in the body, as you see the movement of color and texture and form, in this moment, this very moment, things are being experienced right now. So who is experiencing? What is experiencing all of this? And if we take the time, a few moments, to investigate our own true nature as it already is, we recognize it has no limits. It's silent. It was never born, it could never die, and it has no fixed position on anything. So when we look at the world from that perspective, from that recognition, which is incidentally exactly what we do with people in awakening coaching, when we encourage people in this way, then we see the other in a mysterious way as both me and also separate. It's separate in its appearance. It's a different hair color. It's a different age, maybe, different eye color, and different way of expressing itself. But the aliveness, the presence living through that person is me. It's the same consciousness everywhere. So you could say, you are an expression of me. I could say, I'm an expression of you. It's the same statement. It's the same ocean expressing itself. And this is very practical. It's not just a mystical escape from reality. It's very, very practical, because that is love. That's how you live love, you see? That's how every little conflict becomes just a tiny thing on the surface, a tiny wave in an ocean of love. Because love is to see yourself in the other and to see the other in you and to realize that in essence we are the same. That's love, you know? That's also the source of all creativity. When you have access to this infinite consciousness, which is your true nature, when problems arise, they don't overwhelm you. They become interesting opportunities to bring forth creativity, because you're connected to the source of all creativity. Where do problems get solved from? Where do new ideas come from? They come out of the source, which is the same in all of us.
Well, and we have a lot of different words for that source, and that's where we get all mixed up. And that's what, you know, my teacher, Ramana Maharshi, that was his only thing that he taught. Who am I? You just keep coming back to that question. Who am I? It's self-inquiry. And when you get down deep, deep into the root of it, you aren't doctor, wife, mother, sister, daughter, you know, whoever you are as a volunteer worker, your philanthropist, you're not any of it. Those are the roles that you play, but you actually are the infinite. And we're all basically reflections of God, if you want to use that word. So it's just this very interesting place to be, because, as you say, all the rest falls away.
Yeah.
So important. Yeah. And, of course, that can have you living happily all the time, if you can remember that.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that's where we need to develop an intelligent and a creative relationship to practice, because my teacher was H.W. Alpunja, who was actually who lived with Ramana Maharshi, and Punjaji, he was an incredible man. I don't know if you ever heard of him or if you ever met him, but he lived in India until 1997, and he asked me to return to the West. The way he put it was, he said, to share this secret with your friends. He said, go home and share this secret with your friends, right? Which was his way of saying, go and teach, you know? So I did that. I went home and I started to share this secret with my friends, which means that I was really reminding people of who they really are. But I realized reminding people of who they are experientially is quite easy. For somebody to have a little taste of their true nature is without limits, that's relatively easy. But to actually sustain that taste in relationship, when dealing with money, to sustain that taste in finding your true sense of purpose in the world, to sustain that taste when faced with a health challenge, that's actually where most people get challenged. You know, we can have right. we can have these tastes of awakening in meditation or with a teacher or in retreat, but that's not very difficult. The challenging thing is, how do we shift our whole relationship to reality so that we are meeting each moment as love without boundaries? So we're meeting each moment as consciousness, which is free and which is full of solution instead of full of challenge. And that's where we have developed, you know, in awakening coaching, we've developed a very systematic relationship to practice, because we don't want to develop practices, you know, which are become a form of postponement. You know, I'm going to do this practice so that later I can be enlightened. That's not necessary.
Right.
But we do somehow need practice so that we can take the presence that we already are and bring it creatively into every moment, so that we can live really free. You know, the solution in past centuries was to avoid the world. You know, so-called spiritual people would avoid the world, avoid relationship, avoid money, avoid family, avoid everything, renounce the world, become a monk or a recluse, so you don't have to deal with these challenges. And that's not really a solution. You know, that's
one of my teachers calls that spiritual bypass.
Spiritual bypassing, exactly. Robert yep. Augustus Masters wrote a book called Spiritual Bypassing. Yeah, so that's not really the solution. You know, you don't graduate college by not showing up to class, you know?
Right.
So somehow real freedom is where you can be in relationship, you can be in sexuality, you can be a parent, you can be artistic, you can go to work, you can deal with money, you can make a social and political difference. You are completely free to move through this world without restriction, all the time connected to who you are. And that's where we need tools, and that's really what we've done. That's what awakening coaching is all about. That's what's in the book, you know, is tools that allow us to live in a way that's free, in a way that shifts your relationship from consumption to contribution. Instead of being here to get something from the world, you're here to contribute out of a sense of who you are as infinite.
Well, let's talk about the brilliances.
Mm. Yeah. Would you like me to just dive in?
Dive right in.
Yeah, well, so as I mentioned, you know, we've developed a way of working with people which is peer-based. Peer-based means non-hierarchical, friends helping friends, which can bring the same kind of depth or even a greater depth to awakening and to living awakening than traditionally we have seen in a hierarchical teacher-student context. And the reason that this really happened for me was I was living with my teacher in India, and, you know, I was used to being a student. You know, I knew what it was like to be a student and to look up to somebody who you thought was more enlightened or more evolved or more advanced than you. And then he asked, Punjaji asked me to return to America and to teach. So I returned to America and I did that. And a few years passed and then I realized, wow, the same dynamic has just happened again. But now the role is reversed. I've become the guy sitting on the elevated platform and everyone's looking to me thinking that I'm somehow in a better state. So I thought, this cannot be, you know, this is not the way I want to live my life, I don't want to live my life from a pedestal.
Right. So there's a long way to fall. I said there's a long ways to fall.
The higher you fly, the further is to fall. So yeah. I started to look at it really, and I thought, you know, what is this? I mean, because I'm just a regular guy who went to India and met this teacher and experienced some things in myself, and now I'm able to pass it on. So there's nothing special about me. It was just being in the right place at the right time. So then I asked myself, how can that be communicated? You know, how can that actually be passed on in a way that other people can do the same thing? So with a group of, I started to train people back in 1994. And over many, many years, as a community, we've been able to discover the qualities which can allow anybody to become an excellent facilitator of awakening to anybody else. So we've been able to isolate these seven skills or qualities. We call them innate brilliances. Innate means that you have them anyway. They just have to be brought forth. Seven innate brilliances which can allow you or me or anybody listening to this radio show, anybody can learn to become a really good facilitator of awakening who can deliver consistent results. You know, and it's an unusual word to use, unusual choice of words in the kind of spirituality arena, but I think it's important that people can learn to deliver consistent results time after time after time, so it's not haphazard. You know, you can press button A and expect result B. So I can list these briefly. The first we call inspired certainty. And inspired certainty simply means that you've had a deep enough taste of your own presence, your own existence as oceanic, that you can listen to somebody else's problems with compassion and empathy. You can say, okay, I understand this situation's hard for you, but at the same time, you know that the story of drama is arising in a bigger context of consciousness, of awareness.
Right.
The second quality we call absolute presence, which means that you know how to show up for another human being in a way that is completely there. You know, it's one of the most important healing things about a practitioner is when somebody goes to see a practitioner, one of the most important things that really makes a difference is they can feel the other person is really there. You know, that's one of the, I tell a few stories in the book, that's one of the most powerful things that clients say to me is, wow, you know, I really felt you were there for me. And so we have methods, we train people into how you can actually put yourself aside, which means put your thoughts and feelings aside and really be present for another person in a way that they can really feel it and be nourished and transformed by it. The third we call radical awakening, which is a method that we use which allows somebody to shift from preoccupation with thoughts and feelings and desires and fears into a recognition of being infinite consciousness in 10 minutes or less. You know, we don't want to make this complicated. There's no reason to make your true nature into a kind of a lifelong journey. That's kind of ridiculous. You know, if you're the very words, your true nature means you are already that. So we can't make what you already are into a journey that gets postponed into the future. So that's a very important thing, is that we can recognize the immediate availability and the immediate undeniable presence in this moment of infinite consciousness, of the context in which other things are occurring. Many times people feel, well, because I'm having thoughts or negative thoughts or feelings, therefore I've lost it, or I don't have this infinite consciousness. But we fail to see that even the most negative, darkest thoughts, they are moving in a medium. It's a wave moving in a medium, and the medium that it's moving in is consciousness. You know, it's like, it would be like going to the movies and seeing a movie of terrible, you know, destruction, like Silence of the Lambs or something, and saying, oh my God, now I've lost the white screen. Now, you can't lose the white screen. The white screen is the medium on which the movie is being projected, you see. So awakening
actually,
does not...
I'm going to interrupt you right here, because I'd like you to tell the story of your journey from India at your guru's feet to Silence of the Lambs on Orcas Island.
Oh, sure. Okay, that's a funny story. Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot for that. Yeah. Well, yeah, so after my teacher, Punjaji, asked me to come back and to teach, I actually moved directly to Seattle, where I think you are now, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I moved to Seattle, back to my house on Finney Ridge, near Green Lake, and I started teaching. And you know, it's kind of funny. What do you do if you come back from India and somebody's told you to teach? What are you going to do? You can't, you know, you can't really suddenly call your friends and say, "Well, I'm a teacher now. You should come and sit with me." But slowly, people did contact me and said, "You know, I hear you've been in India with this guy, and I'd like to hear a little bit about it." So slowly, people started coming, and it got to be more people and more people, and so you know, we developed a little kind of community. And after a few months, I was invited to Orcas Island, which, as you know, is just a ferry ride away from Seattle. So I went out to Orcas Island, and this woman had been very gracious. She had a big house on a big property, 5 acres on Orcas Island, and it was facing towards the, I want to say towards the west, I think. But anyway, it got a lot of strong winds off the ocean. So she had this big house, old house, on 5 acres, and she said, "Don't worry, I've got another house in town." What's the name of the town there?
Well, there are a couple, but East Sound is one.
East Sound, yeah. She said, "I've got an apartment in East Sound. I'll stay in the apartment. You get the whole house to yourself." I said, "Well, that's very kind of you." So she had about 100 people come to this old house, and we had our meeting together. And during the day, I went into East Sound to the video rental store. This is back in the days of VHS, you know. And I thought, wow, I've been in India for quite a while, and I haven't actually seen a movie for a long time. So I really want to kind of ease back into it gently. You know, I don't want to go straight for something overwhelming. I want to find almost like a Disney movie. So I was looking on the shelves of the different movies, and then there was a box there with a butterfly on the cover. I thought, well, that's sweet. There's a butterfly, and it was called The Silence of the Lambs. I thought, oh, that's so wonderful. That's like such a spiritual title, The Silence of the Lambs. And it had a picture of a butterfly, and it had Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins. And I thought, well, that's going to be the movie for me. That must be a very sweet spiritual movie. So I brought it home. And after everyone had left the meeting at about 10 o'clock at night, I thought, okay, now I'm going to watch my movie. So everybody was gone. I was on 5 acres by myself. And I switch on this movie on an old TV set. I get a little food, and I'm eating a little food watching this movie. And slowly, you know, I'm 10 minutes in, 15 minutes in, and then I realized, oh, this is not the Disney movie that I thought it was. You know, this is actually heavy-duty stuff. You know, if you know the story, it's kind of intense film.
I know the story, but I've never seen it because I know what it's about.
You want to make sure you're not sleeping alone after that film. So, so the film continued, and I was left in a dilemma, you know, because I was in this old house that was creaking in the wind with these strong winds, and every time it creaked, of course, I was terrified. So I was thinking, well, what am I going to do? You know, if I switch it off now, I'm going to just fantasize the most incredibly gruesome, horrible ending you could imagine. So the only thing I can really do is hope for a happy ending. You know, there's nothing else that I can do, really. I can just sit here and hope that it works out okay. So I sat there for 2 hours watching this really terrible film about, you know, cannibalism, basically, hoping it would come to a nice conclusion. And it actually got worse and worse. But here was the thing, is as I was sitting there watching it, I realized in every single moment I had a choice, right? And the choice was to let the attention really go into the film, to get lost in the film, in which case I would get very freaked out and I would get very, you know, really upset, and it would be very intense. So I could go into the film like that and potentially suffer, or I could pull back from the film, right? I could pull back from the film, in which case it would just be a little boring. If I'm just sitting there constantly remembering this is a TV set with actors, you know, I might as well, it doesn't really do anything for me. So I found the art watching that film of going in and out. You know, I'd go into the movie enough to be entertained, but I'd pull back enough to recognize that it was a movie. And in that way, I survived Silence of the Lambs. I actually enjoyed Silence of the Lambs because I was kind of partway in and partway out, you see? Mm-hmm. And that became a fantastic learning for me because it actually taught me how to live life. You know, that's actually was a powerful learning in how to get through life, because that's how you live a great life, is you're just involved enough that you're enthusiastic, you're passionate, you're creative, you can love deeply, you care about people, you care about things, but you have enough of a sense of being oceanic that you also realize it's a play. It's an appearance. It's actors. It's a movie. So when somebody dies, yes, a part of you is sad because that person is no longer alive, but a part of you also knows that consciousness does not die, you see? And when you lose money, a part of you is frustrated and disappointed because you wanted to use the money for something special, but a part of you can laugh and say, this is just like Monopoly, you know, the money comes, the money goes. So this was really learning how to survive Silence of the Lambs was also how I learned the art of intelligent living. Because if you pull back too much, if you try and develop too much of a spiritual lifestyle where you're always feeling in deep meditation, you know, you just kind of lose your edge like that. You can easily get bored and wonder why you're here and just lose your passion. But on the other hand, if you go too much into life, if you play the stock market and play the dating game like your life depends on it, you're going to get very stressed. So there's this way of living which is just spacious enough that you have freedom and humor, and just engaged enough that you have passion. And that is really the essence, what I've just said there, is the essence of what we call awakening coaching, is training people how to live in that way.
Well, I know we haven't finished the brilliances, but I want to move to the difference between masculine and feminine energy and practices.
You've got all the best questions, don't you?
Well, I read the book.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, you know, the beauty of a coaching model, Keisha, is that it's not one size fits all. You know, that there were teachers who came, for example, from India back in the 1960s, who had a kind of one size fits all teaching. You know, everybody should meditate. Everybody should... Wait a minute, I'm saying it the wrong accent. Everybody should meditate. Everybody meditate 20 minutes twice a day.
You better be doing a head wobble at the same time.
A head wobble, yeah. So we had a lot of teachers come over from India and Tibet and everything who really had the same teaching for everybody, the same practice for everybody.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the best way to go, you know? Because people are different. People are unique. And one of the most fundamental differences between people is gender, right? There's a lot of other things that you can smudge between people, but the gender is the most fundamental difference. If someone is a man or a woman, that's actually, you know, my buddy John Gray, he actually puts the analogy like men and women are actually from different planets, you know. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus, you know. And so... in recognizing this, one of the most tragic things really that's happened in the name of spirituality is a one-size-fits-all approach to practice, where because spirituality, like many things, like business and politics and many things, spirituality has really been dominated for thousands of years by the masculine psyche, by the masculine part of all of us. So it's emphasized what the masculine usually emphasizes, which is reaching a goal, breaking through obstacles, maintaining control, and has placed less emphasis on feelings. So enlightenment is a hyper-masculine concept. You see, it's the idea of working hard with austerity for many, 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 many decades or even lifetimes, and eventually you'll reach this goal and go to heaven. That's a super masculine concept. It's like football. You know, football is a game mostly enjoyed by men who have to break through the opposition, either through speed or skill or just force, and then they manage to score a goal. And that's and then there's this huge moment of relief. Well, the masculine has done pretty much that to everything it turns its attention to. So business becomes like that. And politics becomes like that. You win a war. So it's interesting to ask ourselves, you know, what is feminine practice? And we've really investigated that a lot. And we've discovered that the practices that allow a woman, or at least the feminine part of all of us, the practices that allow the feminine in all of us to come home to a feeling of peace and freedom are very different than the practices that allow a man to come home. For a man, meditation, centering, solitude, they can be very good. For a woman, I mean, of course, women have a masculine side, so I'm not suggesting that women should never meditate, but I've certainly met a lot of women who've put decades of their lives into meditation, and they still remained feeling disconnected, and they still had a high level of stress. And those same women, if they integrate dance, for example, or even singing, or anything that involves the expression of feeling through the body, that can be much, much more effective and allow them to come home to themselves much more quickly and easily than if they had practiced tools designed for men. So there's a whole section in the book about that, the difference between masculine and feminine practice. And I think it's a very, very important topic for us to become aware of, that what's good for John may not be good for Mary, you know?
It's a very important point, because I also believe that sometimes the things that we are naturally drawn to aren't really going to help us evolve very much. So my husband teaches meditation. He spent a lot of years in India at the feet of his guru. And, you know, he could meditate for 7 days a month, 4 months, 6 months, 4 years straight, has gone ahead and done it, you know. But does that help him integrate? And he realized that later on in his life and said, okay, I have all these hours of meditation, but am I integrating what I'm getting into my daily life? And is that helping me, you know, really grow? Whereas for me, I'm more nurturing and in service of others during my day. And so actually it's really important that I take some time to sit and be still, you know. And so I think it's very important that we realize that we're not all, and this is another thing that medicine falls short on, where we think evidence-based medicine is the gold standard in the United States, and yet that assumes that we're all standardized people, and that is just simply not true. Yeah. And you cannot give somebody the same food and have their bodies react in exactly the same way. You can't send five people to the same movie and have them come out with the same opinion. It's just not going to happen ever. So I loved reading that. And then the other thing that I loved is your commentary about the ego, because I, of course, great minds think alike, and so you're brilliant. So you're talking about the ego, and I said, yes, you know, because so much of spiritual practice a lot of times is encapsulated in fighting the ego, dominating the ego, winning over the ego, and all of these pieces. And I would love to have you talk about the ego in the way that you did in this book, because I think it's very, very important.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the most fundamental challenges that we face as human beings, which I think is particular to our species, I don't know that there's animals who really have this problem in the same way, is we have a difficulty distinguishing between what is real and what is imaginary. And we are affected by both. You are affected a lot by real things, but you are also affected by imaginary things. You know, people are frequently affected by things that only exist in imagination. So it's very important for us to be able to distinguish between the real and the imaginary, because to get rid of something that's real, you know, like if you develop a lump in your breast, that's something real. It's a real lump. You can feel it, and you need to do something about it. You need to go to the doctor. You need to go to an alternative practitioner. You need to do something, or you're going to potentially die. You know, it's a real thing. But there are many things that we develop that are imaginary. For example, we might develop the idea that somebody doesn't like me. You know, this person doesn't like me. And we never really checked it out. We just have this idea that so-and-so doesn't like me. Well, you're not going to make that go away. Well, I suppose you could go and ask them, you know, but very often you don't make imaginary things go away through action, right?
Well, a personal belief system that says, like, I have to be perfect to be loved or accepted,
right.
That would be one that you can't really
yes.
check out very well. That's very imaginary, you know.
Exactly. Or the kind of general sense of not having enough money, you know.
Right.
This kind of pervasive feeling, I don't have enough money. And you can feel that way even after you've got, you know, you could make a lot of money and still feel you don't have enough money. So some problems we face are not real, they're imaginary. Right? Imaginary. Now, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of kind of funny thing. If you walk down an alleyway late at night in the city, especially, you know, if it's like raining or something, and you walk down an alleyway, and what happens is the sound of your own heels on the
right.
sidewalk actually echoes off the side of the alley. So it gives the appearance of somebody following you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then if you don't realize what's happening, you speed up. And as you speed up, they speed up. So you start running, and they start running, because whatever you do, you're hearing the echo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, you can get more and more worked up about that until you look around and realize you were only hearing the echo of your own footsteps. So imaginary problems, they don't need action exactly. They need waking up. Imaginary problems, you don't solve them by doing something. You solve imaginary problems by shifting your attention. So we've got to ask ourselves with the ego. People talk a lot about the ego in spiritual circles. So before we try and get rid of it through a lot of effort, try to find it. You know, try to actually find it directly. Of course, you can find thoughts and feelings that you say, well, those are proof of the ego. Look, I'm having this thought. But the thought is only a thought. It's just one thought, right? You can, if you're concerned about that one thought, you can just stop thinking it, right? So the ego is actually a concept. You know, it was a concept that was coined by Sigmund Freud. If you study literature or sociology, you'll find the word ego does not appear in the English language prior to Sigmund Freud coining it. Prior to that, it was simply the word for I in Latin. It was a Latin word, but it didn't refer to any kind of psychological entity. It just was a way of speaking, right? So Freud, it was when Freud was translated into English in the 50s that the word ego entered into common parlance. And today, everybody talks about the ego like it's a real thing, but we forget that even our great-grandparents didn't even know what we were talking about, right? So it's a very, very recent invention. People don't really understand that. It's a very recent invention. So the way to get rid of the ego is not to try and battle it or, you know, work on it or anything. The way to get rid of the ego is stop imagining it. And when you stop imagining the sense of a separate entity, what's left is sweetness. What's left is the sound of the birds. What's left is the sun on the trees and the different colors of green. What's left is a flow of benevolence that just comes to you on its own. And if you don't believe me, just wait and see. So there is so much going on in this moment that gets obscured by this preoccupation with something that is actually only made up.
Thank you. That was just very lovely. And I love kind of the final piece that I'll leave with our listeners really quickly so that we can end and give your URL and how to reach you, is I loved how you said the biggest barrier to freedom or peace is distraction. You know, all the distractions that we find around us. And we can't really go into that, but people can get the book to read more about that. And
yeah.
The book, of course, is Better Than Sex. And my guest today has been Arjuna Arda. And if you would like to find his Awakening Coaching, you can go to awakeningcoachingtraining.com. And Arjuna, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I actually do have another site, which is arjunaarda.com.
Okay.
And that's where you can also find the book there. And there's also a little five-day, like, you know, there's a five-day little mini course you can take that introduces you to all of this.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for the good you're up to in the world. And
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. All the best. Thank you.
Remember, everyone, live, love, laugh, learn. Listen to Healthy You Radio Network and have a fantastic day.